Survivors of abuse by Jeffrey Epstein made an emotional plea at the U.S. Capitol this week. Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massie joined them, calling for the release of the Epstein files. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll discuss Massie's bipartisan push. We'll also hear why Vice President J.D. Vance says Republicans need to play hardball when it comes to redistricting, why the Trump administration is targeting Ohio youth prisons over pronouns, and are the few council members who voted against the Hyde Park Square development now saying, "I told you so"? Joining me now to get our news review started is Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Welcome back, Sylvia.
Glad to be here.
As I mentioned, survivors of abuse by Jeffrey Epstein joined Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massie and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene in calling for the release of the Epstein files. Here's one of the survivors, Anuska.
And to be clear, the only motive for opposing this bill would be to conceal wrongdoing. You have a choice. Stand with the truth or with the lies that have protected predators for decades.
Sylvia, explain what Congressman Massie is doing to try to force a vote on releasing these files.
Yeah, so Congressman Massie, who is, of course, the Northern Kentucky Republican representative, is pushing for a discharge petition. So he formerly filed a resolution, legislation to ask the Justice Department to release all the files, but that resolution never moved. It does not have the support of leadership. It doesn't have the support of President Trump. So it kind of just sat in committee. Well, this is a mechanism that allows, if 218 representatives band together, sign a petition, this discharge petition, they can force it to the floor for a vote. So what's happening right now is not the actual vote on the resolution itself. It is a vote to vote on the resolution. I mean, that just kind of speaks to how Washington works. It's vote upon vote. But really, this could be a really big moment, right? It's an opportunity for all Democrats essentially have signed it at this point, but also to kind of show some divisions in the Republican Party as well.
How many signatures does this discharge petition have so far? Do you know the latest count?
The last I checked the clerk's office, which was, I think, 5 minutes ago, is 215. I believe there's one Democrat missing right now, and that Democrat has said he will sign it. I think he had a funeral he had to attend. But only three Republicans besides Representative Massie have signed it. Marjorie Taylor Greene and two others. And he just needs two more Republicans to sign on. He had a number of Republican co-sponsors on that resolution, but so far only three of them have signed it.
Well, we mentioned that survivors of abuse were with Congressman Massie. Tell us about Annie Farmer, another one of the survivors, and what she had to say.
Yeah, so, there are, strangely enough, multiple Kentucky lawmakers and Kentuckians involved in this entire situation. Annie Farmer and her sister were both abused by Jeffrey Epstein. Annie was only 16 when the abuse began. And she called alongside Thomas Massie to release the files. She essentially argued that there is a deepening lack of trust in public institutions in America, and keeping these files secret is only worsening that trust and perpetrating the idea that there are two Americas, one legal system for the rich and one for everyone else. And so she was saying that releasing the files is one step towards transparency to allow survivors to heal and also to start healing some of the trust in our public institutions.
Well, here's Congressman Massie.
This is not a hoax. This is real. There are real survivors. There are real victims to this criminal enterprise. And the perpetrators are being protected because they're rich and powerful and political donors to the establishment here in Washington, D.C.
And here is U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. She had this to say.
I think this is something that was worth fighting for. You see, the women behind me are going to tell you stories that you've never heard before. These are unimaginable horrors that they've lived with for their entire lives since they were very, very young.
Let me ask you this first, Sylvia. Another Kentucky congressman, you mentioned all these connections. James Comer is chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. What's that committee doing about these Epstein files?
Yeah, he's the Kentucky congressman from Western Kentucky, and he's the chair of this oversight committee, which deals with all sorts of different, investigations and whatnot. You know, he's been most vocal about his investigations into former President Joe Biden. But how he's involved in the Epstein case is he's got the support of President Trump in what he's been investigating, which is essentially he's asked the DOJ to release some files. They have a portion of those files. And he recently, actually right after Massey filed this discharge petition, released all of them. Now, Democrats have been critical of that move. They say, I believe, up to 97% of those files were already public. So they're very skeptical that this is really an increase in public disclosure. But, they are investigating. They are looking into it. They are asking the questions, and there's no need for what Thomas Massey is calling for.
Well, and of course, Congressman Comer is a big supporter of President Trump. Sylvia, how has the Trump administration responded to this discharge petition?
The Trump administration, specifically President Trump, has called it a hoax, a Democratic hoax. He says that there's nothing in those files that needs to be made public. You know, the Attorney General Pam Bondi has said that, most of the files they haven't released are just essentially child pornography, that they're, illicit materials, and that they shouldn't be released, they can't be released, and that also they say that survivors don't want it to be released. Of course, at least a large portion of survivors, many survivors did come and say they do want a release of the files, but they say there are some survivors who don't want them released. So, that's kind of the idea. Trump is saying this is just Democrats trying to distract from all the good things that I'm doing. And there's nothing in those files that would actually be important for the public to see.
Has the president taken aim at Congressman Massey specifically over his role in all this?
Oh, he most certainly has. President Trump has not been a fan of Thomas Massey, especially in his second term, over many things, not just the Epstein files. He's been extremely critical of Thomas Massey's criticism. Thomas Massey has been very critical of President Trump this term. I mean, he has fought against President Trump's biggest policy package, the big, beautiful bill, the tax and spending bill that he passed a few months ago, or I guess earlier this summer. And he also has been quite critical of, for example, his attack on Iran, support of Israel, things like that. Thomas Massey has been quite critical of. And that has led President Trump to, call for him to be primaried. One of Trump's top policy advisors has been involved in trying to get someone to run in that race against him. There have been near constant attack ads against Thomas Massey in his district, despite there still isn't currently, as far as I'm aware, a major candidate in the primary against him that's publicly announced. But they're still running attack ads against him. So it's definitely heightened a lot of tensions.
And this doesn't seem to bother Congressman Massey, right? He just seems to keep kind of doing his thing.
Well, actually, now that you say that, the Wall Street Journal put out an article earlier today that was basically said that Thomas Massey did try to ask President Trump to stop the barrage in exchange for some level, it's unclear of how much, some level of support for that big tax and spending bill. Obviously, that fell apart. Thomas Massey did not end up voting for the bill, although he did initially vote for it to continue to a vote. Another Washington, multiple steps just to get to the vote itself. But he clearly that has not materialized into anything. Those ads are still running. Thomas Massey has also started running his own ads. And like you said, yes, Massey has clearly continued. He has not backed down in any way from continuing to criticize the Trump administration, from continuing to support the things that he cares about the most.
Well, we've talked about some survivors as part of this discussion, but another survivor, Lisa Phillips, said that the group has talked about taking action if the government doesn't release more information. What are these survivors talking about doing?
Right. It's a little unclear, I'll admit. So essentially what Ms. Phillips said is that the survivors have been talking and that they are interested in or they are strongly considering putting together their own list of names. And it's possible they've already started putting together their own list of names if the government refuses to identify individuals who were involved in this in Epstein's large-scale trafficking ring. And they say that they're going to make the list. It's not clear if they would publicly release it. It's unclear if they would hand it over to lawmakers, for example. Marjorie Taylor Greene actually said at that press conference that she would proudly read the names aloud on the floor. But she also noted at the same time that it puts those women at a lot of risk to be the ones to personally identify people, right? Like, it puts them at a risk for plenty of lawsuits. I mean, if they are accurately describing the names on this list, they're, you know, describing powerful people. So that's kind of the fear that they are saying is why they haven't released names thus far, and why they really want the DOJ, they want the federal government to take that step. They don't want to be the ones to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because presumably these women had direct contact with some of the people who are on this list, but I can understand why they'd be worried about being the ones to release those names.
And that's the implication, yeah.
Right. What's the next step with this discharge petition? You mentioned that there are still a few more signatures that Congressman Massey needs to get. Is there a deadline for this? How does the process work?
I don't believe there is a deadline. I could be wrong. I'm sure there are, is, you know, obviously the deadlines of the that exist just in, you know, like elections and things like that. But as far as I'm aware, there is not a tight deadline. It could take weeks. But essentially, he just needs those two Republican votes. And there have been Republicans in the past, you know, several years that have called for more transparency around the Epstein case, that have talked about some of the conspiracy theories around Epstein. Like I said, there were many other Republicans who did, in fact, sign on to Massey's original resolution who have not signed this discharge petition. So it's going to be really interesting to see, is Massey able to kind of whip those votes? He said before the press conferences where survivors shared their stories that he, or I actually shared it at the end of that press conference, that he had hoped that their stories would convince his Republican colleagues to sign on to take a stand, frankly, against President Trump, because it is against Trump's wishes for this discharge petition to move forward. Although, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massey have been clear, they don't believe it's an act against the Trump administration. They just believe that it's something that they need to do as a nonpartisan move. But it really comes down to if they're able to whip those votes at the end of the day. We'll see if he's able to pull that off.
Well, I've been talking with Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Thank you so much for your time today, Sylvia. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we'll hear what Vice President J.D. Vance has to say about redistricting. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Vice President J.D. Vance says Republicans need to play hardball when it comes to redistricting. Joining me now to talk about why redistricting has caught the eye of the Trump administration and other news in politics are Cincinnati Inquirer political reporter Haley B. Miller and Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman. Welcome back, Haley and Jake.
Good to be here.
Haley, Ohio has to draw new congressional maps this year. Remind us why.
So back in 2022, lawmakers approved a set of congressional maps, but it was only supported by Republicans. And under the current rules for redistricting in Ohio, if a map is not bipartisan, it's only in effect for 4 years. So that is why we have to go back to the drawing table this year, unlike other states such as Texas, which are electing to do this without any requirements.
Well, you mentioned Texas. Texas lawmakers approved new maps to create more Republican majority congressional districts in that state. Vice President J.D. Vance recently talked to USA Today about all this. What did he have to say?
Yeah, he believes that Republicans need to counter what he calls basically rigging of maps by Democratic leaders and Democratic-led states. You know, thinking about California, for example, when Texas was drawing its districts, California Governor Gavin Newsom came out and said that California was going to counter that by, you know, increasing the number of Democratic seats that they have in their state. So Vance and the Trump administration say that, you know, Democrats have rigged the system. I think it's fair to say across the country, both Republicans and Democrats have used redistricting to their advantage to give themselves more power. So it's a very bipartisan thing, but another key part of this for the Trump administration is that Republicans have a very narrow House majority right now, and they're going into a contentious midterm election cycle, and they want to use all the tools that they have at their disposal to try to increase that majority.
So, does the Trump administration see Ohio as a state where it could gain more congressional seats during the redistricting process?
I think so. Vance said that he had not talked recently with Governor Mike DeWine about redistricting. It's unclear to me whether he's talked with other state house leaders about this, but there definitely is an appetite in Ohio among Republican leaders to increase the majority here. Republicans hold 10 of 15 congressional seats in Ohio right now, and there's talk that they could draw a map to potentially increase that to 13. They're looking at districts such as Representative Marcy Kaptur's up in Toledo, Representative Amelia Sykes in the Akron area, and there's even some talk that they may take a look at Landsman's district in Cincinnati and see if there's anything they can do to maybe give Republicans an advantage.
Well, and Republicans are in control of this whole process, right?
Right. So there's not as much of a pushback as there was last time we did this. Republicans are in control of the map making process itself. And then with the Ohio Supreme Court, that is predominantly Republican at this point. When we did this in 2022, Republicans had a 4-3 majority on the court, but Maureen O'Connor, former Chief Justice, sided with Democrats on a lot of these rulings, contending that the maps that Republicans drew at the time were gerrymandered, and that buffer really does not exist on the court now.
How have Ohio Republican lawmakers responded to the idea that, they could end up creating more congressional districts where Republicans have an advantage in the election?
I think Republicans want to see Republicans have an advantage, but you've also heard people like House Speaker Matt Huffman say that they're going to do the task before them. They're not going to let outside politics influence how they draw their maps. We'll see if that ends up being the case, but certainly I don't think there's as much of a need for the White House to put pressure on Ohio as they have been in states such as Indiana, for instance, because Republicans in Ohio already seem pretty willing to try to increase their majority here.
Yeah, and U.S. Senator Bernie Moreno, he has said he expects some districts to change, right?
Yeah, he, I believe, referenced that 13-2 possibility that I mentioned. Kaptur, for example, she's been a target of Republicans for several election cycles now, and they've made her district harder and harder for a Democrat to win. She's been able to still win elections because, she's been in office for a long time. She had some weaker opponents in the past couple cycles, so she almost certainly is a target in a place where Republicans feel like they can be really competitive next year.
You talked with Jen Miller of the League of Women Voters of Ohio. What did she have to say about all this?
Yeah, I think there's a sense among, voting rights advocates, fair maps advocates like Jen Miller that, both sides of the aisle have weaponized redistricting, as I mentioned. I'm from Illinois, for example, and I think everyone there pretty openly acknowledges that the maps are disproportionately benefiting Democrats. So both parties do this, and people like Jen say that neither party should be doing this, and this is a bad practice in general, bad for democracy. I think there's a concern that this discussion has elevated so significantly, but also some hope that perhaps as more people learn more about redistricting, see how gerrymandering is used as a political tool, that there will perhaps be an appetite to call for reform at a national level at some point down the road.
Jake, immigration is another Trump administration priority. How many jails in Ohio are detaining people for ICE?
Yeah, it's a tougher question to pin an answer on than one would hope, because there's a lot of opacity with the contracts in play here. But according to ICE's data right now, there are at least four Ohio County sheriffs who have opened their jails to people held on or called detainers for ICE, which is basically a recognition that ICE, in its enforcement of federal immigration laws, wants these people held. So we, the county jail, for a fee, will hold them. There are also two regional jails who are doing the same. One of those is privately operated. One of them is jointly operated by a handful of Northwest Ohio counties. And then you have a few more counties around the state who have contracts in place to work with ICE, but there are no inmates reflected in ICE data that are in their cells. But so all told, it's about eight sheriffs and two regional jails.
You mentioned contracts. How does that work? Do the sheriffs or the counties or somebody, they sign some kind of agreement?
I mean, the way to think about this is the Trump administration is waging this mass deportation operation, which, when you think about it, all morality or ethics or however one feels about immigration aside, it's a logistical nightmare. It's a very difficult thing to get so many people in a very big country out of the country. So they have deputized, for lack of a better word, a lot of these local law enforcement operations to help with the transportation and the housing. And the fees vary, but it's usually around $100 to $125 per head per day that the sheriffs hold. And right now in Ohio, it is the sheriffs that have signed these contracts, the sheriff's offices, as opposed to county commissions, which is a wonky detail, but it has gained some importance after a legal opinion from the attorney general's office, the state attorney general's office, that says only county commissions can legitimately enter these kinds of contracts. So that has sparked some interest from the ACLU, who is making the argument right now, just in the court of a public opinion. There's no lawsuit to this effect yet, but they are making an argument that these contracts are all invalid, so therefore any detention that flows from them is illegitimate. So it's hard to know what an outcome like that would be, except you'd think if the courts buy it, it would mean these people must be able to walk free. These sheriffs cannot just hold these people on behalf of the federal government.
You just mentioned a dollar amount there. Do counties who sign these agreement or sheriffs who sign these agreement with ICE, do they make money from this practice?
Yeah, so counties in the past, counties have done this sort of thing. Usually it's a shorter time frame, but say the US Department of Justice or the FBI is interested in a person and a sheriff comes across them, the sheriff would hold that person and would try to recover those costs from the federal government. That's like a long-standing, almost a courtesy between law enforcement agencies. But here, I think you kind of need to think about a jail as almost an investment vehicle. You pay a lot of money to build it. You have these operational costs that are unavoidable no matter how many people are in it. And a lot of the jails that are participating have open space. And so any open space, again, if you just think about this in dollars and cents terms, is money that you could otherwise be getting if you had people to fill it with. You can't just go creating more crime. I suppose you could try to capture more criminals, but in any event, I think some of these sheriffs have just found a new revenue stream to capitalize on some of their empty space. And some of them are very explicit. When you read their public comments, I'm thinking of Mahoning County Sheriff Jerry Green. He has been very outspoken that he doesn't come across as an ideologue. This is just $125 per head per day for about 90 prisoners. So if you do the math, that's a nice couple million dollars that now they don't have to go to the taxpayer for. He actually said they're creating a rainy day fund. So there's a pretty clear financial gain for some of these sheriffs. Although I will note that the Buckeye State Sheriffs Association denied any kind of profit-seeking interest from these sheriffs who have signed these deals.
You mentioned an outspoken sheriff here in our region. Butler County Sheriff Richard Jones has been quite outspoken. He's immigration is a big priority for him too. How many detainees is the Butler County Jail holding for ICE?
Yeah, that's quite a question, because if you look on ICE's data, the number's about 100. I'd refer readers to the original story for the specific number, but that number just does not square with the jail census reports that have been reported in local media, which has it closer to 400, 450, which kind of goes to some of the opacity problems I mentioned. I'll add here that Sheriff Jones declined opportunities to comment for this article, but There are a lot. And so I think I did the math at 400. If you take an average of 400 inmates per day, that comes out to about $18 million for the county. So that's a lot of money for a sheriff's office.
Yeah. Well, I know Signal Ohio also reported on Ohio juvenile prisons, and the Trump administration has taken aim at Ohio's youth prisons. Can you tell us a little bit about why that is?
Yeah, there's something called the Personal Responsibility Education Program. This actually came out of the Affordable Care Act. Functions almost like a health class. It's a federally funded program, an educational program for teenagers, and it teaches both non-abstinence only sex ed, so sort of with the mindset that kids are going to have sex, so you might as well teach them to avoid pregnancies and avoid STI transmission. And then there's also some life education stuff rolled in there, how to, negotiate a salary, hold down a job, save up for whatever have you, that sort of thing. And within that program, there were, and this was federally approved under the Biden administration, I'll add here, but there were some pieces of there about preferred pronouns, respecting people's diversity, teaching the concepts of gender identity and expression. And the Trump administration sent a letter to the head of DYS basically saying, we've hit some red flags. These are inappropriate. These are not authorized by statute. You need to pull these.
Huh. How has the Ohio Department of Youth Services responded to that?
I'd say they've been very, they've heeded, they're going to heed what the Trump administration wants here. A spokesman added that they were caught a little flat-footed. These were approved by the Biden administration. This isn't something that they're going rogue and rolling out, but spokesman Aaron Mulvey said, we are going to heed the federal administration's directive. And I believe there's money on the line here, so that's about what any state agency would do.
Yeah. Well, Haley, I want to come back to you. We talked earlier about Senator Bernie Moreno. What role has he been carving out for himself so far during this term?
Yeah, he really has emerged as a top advocate for the Trump administration, despite being a freshman lawmaker. He actually ended up landing a leadership job in the Senate, which is pretty rare for someone who's brand new to the Senate, given that's generally a place that really appreciates seniority. But I think Republicans at least have liked what they've seen from him so far. He has a tendency to put himself at the center of, the big issues of the day, whether it was the fight in Cincinnati, for example, or the closure of a paper mill in Chillicothe recently. So he's kind of been all over, and the through line of that is really just defending Trump, even if that's, not necessarily what people want to hear.
What do his supporters say about that, about his rise to a leadership role and his involvement in all these local issues?
They're impressed by him. I've heard it. It's been described to me more than once that he was a hard worker on the campaign trail, and a lot of people are seeing that play out in his time at in the Senate as well. I think everyone was a little surprised that he got a leadership job, just because that's not how the Senate generally works, but his supporters see that as a testament to his work ethic and the perspective that he brings as a businessman, which is one that does not tend to have much patience for the slow movement of government.
What do his detractors say about what he's doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who believe that he is doing more to benefit Trump in the White House than he's doing to benefit Ohio. He was at a forum with the City Club of Cleveland a few weeks ago and got a lot of heat from people as he was defending the big, beautiful bill. A lot of people are frustrated that both he and Senator John Husted supported that when, it makes cuts to Medicaid, to food assistance. There are some things in the bill that Moreno and other supporters say will benefit Ohio, but there's just a lot of frustration over that legislation and how it's going to impact people. And I don't necessarily think that, especially his detractors, want to hear him defending that.
Well, but as much as he has supported the Trump administration, he's also worked with some Democrats on legislation, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. He was in Columbus recently for a news conference on housing and talked about some legislation he's done with Democrats to streamline housing construction and things like that. He's worked with some Democrats in Wisconsin and Michigan that are... I'm familiar with one of the Democrats because I used to live in Wisconsin, and she tends to work with Republicans on, you know, issues where she feels like it makes sense to both of them. And I think Marino is the same way. You know, he will partner with Democrats on things where it makes sense, but he's also willing to be very partisan and, you know, a strong advocate for the Republican Party and very open to criticizing Democrats, especially former Senator Sherrod Brown.
You know, you mentioned before that he's gotten in these local issues he's gotten involved in. And of course, around here, that's the brawl in Cincinnati that went viral, or the video of the brawl that went viral. He came to Cincinnati and he threatened to pull federal funding after that video went viral and the concerns that it raised. He's backed off that threat, hasn't he?
Yeah, he met with Mayor Perval recently, and the mayor said that, you know, they had a productive discussion, that Marino had walked back that threat, but I think there was still some frustration among leaders in Cincinnati about how Marino handled everything, especially at the beginning. You know, he was very critical of city leaders, and advocates in Cincinnati say that he's been painting a false picture of crime in the city and just basically making Cincinnati look bad. And, you know, you've seen not just Marino, but other Republicans make crime a big issue in Ohio and nationally recently. So I think that was definitely a piece of it for Marino as well, kind of continuing that Republican mission of trying to make crime a big issue right now.
Okay, well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer political reporter Haley B. Miller and Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman. Thank you both so much for your time today. It was great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, will Cincinnati City Council spend nearly $5 million more on public safety? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati City Council could soon spend an additional $4.6 million on public safety. Joining me now to explain why and to discuss the latest on the Hyde Park Square redevelopment is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
Becca, I want to start with Hyde Park Square. Cincinnati City Council voted yesterday to repeal a zone change for a Hyde Park Square redevelopment project. Explain briefly the zone change council approved in April. It wasn't that long ago that they approved this whole thing.
That's right. And it was a 7-2 vote in April. So most council members did support that zone change. So there's a part of Cincinnati zoning code called a planned development. And it's if it's a meets some minimum requirements like multiple buildings and a minimum acreage size, then developers can say, you know, let's kind of give a design what we want it to look like. And that might include taller than current zoning code or, you know, maybe less parking spaces than are required. And they can kind of package it all together in a planned development. And that's what council approved in April. There was a huge backlash from community opponents. To be fair, the backlash started or the opposition started before the council vote, but it continued after that. And so it's the designation of planned development that council yesterday voted to repeal. And that was at the request of developers because they ultimately decided to rescind their original application.
Well, you talked about this backlash and the opposition to this project, and the people who opposed it really took action. Explain what they did.
Yeah, so they organized a referendum. So what that requires is gathering a minimum number of signatures. This year, it was about 9,000 signatures that would be required to put the referendum on the ballot in November. And that would have given voters members the option to do what council ended up doing yesterday, which is to repeal the planned development designation. Now, they collected, these opponents collected over 18,000 signatures. It turned out that more than 13,000 were valid. It's common for many signatures to be thrown out because people might think they live in the city of Cincinnati, but they don't actually, or they're not registered to vote, and so those signatures are not valid. But over 13,000 valid signatures, which is well over the minimum they needed, and a pretty significant milestone.
Now, there have been negotiations in recent weeks to try to make changes to the development that both sides can agree on, but those didn't get anywhere?
I wouldn't say didn't get anywhere, but they did not reach a final plan that everyone is happy with. And most recently, two council members kind of mediated a meeting between the two groups. This was Councilmember Seth Walsh, who supported the zone change back in April, and Councilmember Scotty Johnson, who was one of two who opposed the zone change. So they kind of came together for that reason. It's after the meeting, it seemed like there was some agreement on lots of things, compromises that the development team was willing to make to the design. But ultimately, they did not reach an agreement. Some described it as an impasse. And it was after that meeting, a few days after that meeting, that the development team sent their letter to Mayor Aftab Pureville to say, hey, please put this repeal on the council agenda. We're going to resubmit a new application, and let's not let this go to the ballot.
You mentioned that two council members voted against that original zone change.
That's right.
Did either of them have an I told you so moment during council?
Not quite. Not those words, certainly. But it was an interesting discussion because council passed the repeal unanimously. And that's not surprising because it was at the request of the developer. But several council members did have thoughts on their perspective on what this looked like. Many of them, I think, as you mentioned, were kind of urging the two sides to keep talking and try to come to some kind of agreement. Mostly what we heard from those two council members, who were Scotty Johnson, the other was Vice Mayor Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, they really kind of praised the opponents and said, you really, addressing them, did the hard work of making sure your voice was heard. And that's an amazing example to the rest of the city. And so they really kind of celebrated what they saw as kind of a victory. Although talking to some of the opponents, they're not calling victory on this because it's not the end of this saga.
Sure. What were the council discussions like, other than that praise for the people who gathered all those signatures?
It was a little tense at times. Two votes, one in committee on Tuesday and then up for a final vote in the full council meeting on Thursday. And there were some statements from council members who supported the original zoning change, saying, there does need to be better understanding of what community engagement looks like. You know, what can developers expect when they go into a community with a proposed project, and what are the requirements or kind of the minimum of community engagement, what that should look like. And then some back and forth about, I think everyone agrees that the city does need more housing. Opponents saying we don't need more expensive housing. Others saying, well, actually, we need all housing because of supply and demand. And those are issues that have been debated many times at City Hall. But there was some interesting back and forth on that.
What's next for this specific project? Are the developers working on an alternative? Will opponents be involved in that process?
Yeah, so what we know now, the development team did release renderings of a proposed new design for the project. And so the current version of that is up to 75 feet for the buildings, which is shorter, about 10 and a half feet shorter than what the planned development that was approved. It also includes no hotel, which many opponents were against, fewer parking spaces, and a few other changes. It is still kind of a vague plan right now. It's not something that's super detailed, but that is the plan that the development team has told me they plan to pursue. Now, the opponents that I've talked to are still not happy with that. They say 75 feet is still too tall. Current zoning requires up to 50 feet, or allows up to 50 feet, rather. So it is a significant ways above the current zoning. It's unclear if there will be further discussions or negotiations between the two. I think that's what at least opponents hope. But it's not clear. It might depend on which path a developer takes to pursue this new plan.
How quickly could a more detailed plan come together?
I would guess it's going to be a while. It's not quite true to say that the development is back to square one. I mean, we do have some renderings and some plans. But in terms of the approval process, it really is back to square one. So that means coordinated site review has to happen again. One path could be the Planning Commission. That's a several-week process to get the application ready to go, to have it reviewed by Planning Commission in time for them to consider it. And then if it goes through Planning Commission, it's another several weeks before it's ready to go to City Council. So it kind of depends a little bit, but at minimum, I'd say nothing is going to be up for approval before the November election.
What are some of the possibilities for a new application for the development? You talked about, going before the Planning Commission. Are there several different paths the developers could take?
There are. So a new planned development application is possible, and that would mean kind of starting over with the application. But a planned development would include variances or permission for various things that would be against what current zoning code. So that can include parking minimums, density for the housing portion of it, height. We've already mentioned setback, things like that. Another option is that the developer could just pursue individual variances as needed. So any project can ask for basically zoning relief is the term. They can say, hey, we have a project that meets all the requirements, except it's too tall. Can we get permission to build taller than what current zoning code allows? That's an administrative process. So the zoning hearing examiner decides whether to approve those. And there's some other kind of more complicated things there. So that's an option as well. Another option that, to be clear, is not necessarily on the table yet, but it is a possibility, is that City Council could pass a notwithstanding ordinance. It's not quite a planned development, but it would be council saying that, we want the developer to build what they've designed, notwithstanding or kind of disregarding what current zoning code is. That sounds kind of wild, but it is part of our municipal code. It's something that's used a couple times a year. It's not that uncommon.
Has there been any talk about whether this has broader implications for developers or the development process in Cincinnati? What's happened here with the Hyde Park Square project?
Yeah, I think folks on council and the mayor who supported the original design or the plan development design that was approved back in April have kind of said they're really worried about what this message sends or if this sends a message to developers that it's already hard to build housing and that the city's going to make it so much harder with kind of delaying things and reversing approvals that were already approved. Mayor Purval had some kind of strong words to say at the time. And of course, he doesn't vote on these measures. But in introducing the measure yesterday, he's worried. He said he's worried that this process has had a chilling effect on development across the city. So his question is, how can council and community councils and residents work together and developers work together to make it easier to build housing in every neighborhood in the city, not just in Hyde Park?
Well, let's talk about another issue we've talked about many times on this show, and that's crime. Mm-hmm. It sounds like City Council might consider spending more money on public safety. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so public safety already makes up more than 80% of the general fund. So that's, between the police department and the fire department. What's being considered right now is totally separate from the regular city budget. It would be one-time funding. And so what's up for consideration is about $4.6 million. And council member Jeff Kramerding is chair of the Budget and Finance Committee. He has proposed, along with three other council members, kind of an initial plan for how that $4.6 million could be spent. But he's also invited other council members to offer their ideas. So the total amount, it could change, but also how they plan to spend it could change.
Where would that money come from if it's not part of the regular budgeting process?
So the city has several, kind of emergency reserve accounts. And some of those are really significant and it affects the city's bond rating and things like that. This money would come from an account that's not one of the ones that affects the city's bond rating. It's called the General Fund Contingency Account. It is... the purpose is for emergencies or one-time expenses. It will be replenished during the carryover budget, which happens every year. It's basically whatever's left over from the last fiscal year. That process usually happens in like late September, sometime in October. So there's not much concern about, spending money from this account because it will be refilled very soon.
Now, I know you said that what this money would be used for if it gets approved could change, but can you give us a few examples of the kinds of things it might be used for?
Yeah, so the proposal that Kramerding and the other three council members have put forward, the biggest chunk of money will go towards public visibility overtime for Cincinnati police officers. It's a $1.5 million. So this is basically, you know, police visibility is something that's been talked about a lot. The mayor has been on this program talking about the importance of police visibility. But the police department is short staffed. They don't have the number of officers that they're budgeted to have. And so this would be overtime funds to work towards that. Now, exactly how that money would be spent will kind of be up to the Cincinnati Police Department. There's a few other big buckets. You know, a major one would be over $800,000 that would go to 3CDC to expand the Downtown Ambassador Program. So this would fund 9 additional ambassadors, some in downtown, some in over the Rhine, for 1 year. One other would be there's a couple kind of buckets here for different parts of the city or for citywide to install more street lighting and security cameras. So basic kind of crime reduction techniques that are to be determined by both the Cincinnati Police Department and the Department of Transportation and Engineering. And then things like buying more technology or new technology. So replacing outdated license plate readers, expanding the city's FUSIS program, which is a way that private property owners can connect their security cameras and give CPD access to those, and several other things.
When might council vote on all this?
Budget Chair Kramerding invited fellow council members to propose their ideas for how to spend the money, and he expects a discussion in Monday's Budget and Finance Committee. That's this coming Monday, and he expects a vote on that as well. Now, one like caveat is it's just a motion right now, so basically it tells the city administration, here's what we want to spend the money on. The administration would then have to draft a legal ordinance version of that, and so it would get a final vote sometime in the next few weeks.
Okay, well, Becca, everybody who just heard you knows how great you are at your job covering city council. I also want to mention that Stephen Colbert now knows how great you are, because when he was interviewing the NPR CEO, he mentioned Backed Up, the fantastic podcast that you and Ella Rowan did. So
he did. Unbelievable.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I hope it introduces more people to that project. I think it was a great project, and it was one of many examples he listed of the important work of local journalism for NPR member stations. So I'm thrilled that that got a shout out. Very unexpected and very cool.
Yeah, maybe you'll be invited to be on a show.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure that the call is coming any minute now.
That's right. I hope we haven't kept you from answering it. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you so much for your time today, Becca.
Thank you, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Stephen Baum. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. And our next gardening show is coming up next week. I think it's next Wednesday. Be sure to tune in. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.